Good afternoon. Joseph Gabay and Jennifer Kate Aronson on behalf of Milton Tower. This is an appeal from the Superior Court's decision denying Mr. Tower post-conviction relief on issues relative both to his trial and his penalty phase. They are somewhat synergistic and somewhat separated because of the nature of the claims, the allegations as to counsel's failure to properly advocate for Mr. Tower are consistent as to both sides. The challenge of what would have what their actions could and should have brought to his benefit and the prejudice at the trial versus the prejudice at the penalty hearing, of course, are somewhat different. If I may, I'd like to begin with the trial, and much of what the appellant is going to say essentially is an indicator that we find the judgment of the Superior Court to be somewhat contradictory both to a sentencing opinion and quite contradictory to both the evidence, the application of the evidence, and the law as it presently applies in death penalty cases.
Mr. Gabay, two things unrelated. There were 8 or 9 arguments being advanced here. Would help if we know which one we're talking about. Secondly, I observed, because I think that in response to a couple of the arguments, one of the responses in the state's brief was that it had not been raised below. And so on looking at the standard of review portion of the arguments in your brief, I noticed that at no point did you state where the argument had been preserved, which is what the rules require. If I'm wrong about that, then I'll stand corrected, but I didn't see it.
I have to confess, Justice Jacobs, because of the limited time and the nature of what we're talking about, I did not bring the state's brief with me, but I do believe that each of these issues was raised in some fashion below. They might be captured differently, but I don't think there's a requirement that that the caption in the superior, the heading in the Superior Court match the heading here.
No, Mr. Gabay, the requirement is that in the section of the brief where you talk about the standard of review,
Yes, sir.
Appellant must also state where in the record the argument was preserved.
I agree. And to the extent if that occurred, we counsel apologizes. The relative to the trial, the members of the court, it is clear that argument one and argument four are both essentially the trial arguments.
When you say trial, you mean guilt phase?
The guilt phase, yes, sir. I generally break them in because I don't like the guilt phase tends to be something I avoid at trial in front of juries because it's almost a predictor. Much as Dr. Turner said that antisocial personality is almost creates a conviction. The balance of the arguments, except for number 8, essentially deal with the penalty hearing, and argument number 8 deals with the Superior Court's abuse of the subpoena power, which Mr. Taylor sought to exercise.
And when you talk about the arguments that derive from the trial and the the record of the trial, you'll also identify for us why none of those arguments were raised or could not have been raised in the direct appeal.
I think we pointed out, Mr. Chief Justice, that essentially there was a bit of a conflict between the counsel on handling that appeal. They probably should have opted out of it, But one of the reasons they didn't raise it on appeal, I think at least as to the trial part, and for that let me lead in by saying that clearly what was missed for Mr. Taylor was the extreme emotional defense application or the attempt to provide an extreme emotional defense evidence as well as a guilty but mentally ill testimony, which would have been a per se mitigator had it gone to gone to a penalty phase.
So those all flow from your basic argument that there was not a complete and thorough investigation, correct?
Well, I think that's correct, Justice Breyer.
There could not have been an EED defense without the information that you claim was discovered after the first trial took place.
Well, I have to disagree with the way you state. I don't disagree with the way you're thinking of it. I disagree with what counsel knew. Counsel knew there was evidence out there of a potential EED or guilty but mentally ill. They just elected not to, or were unable, or not.
Okay, so that argument doesn't rest on an incomplete investigation claim.
Well, it certainly does.
Well, either it does or it doesn't.
Well, no, because the rule is you can know something, but you still must thoroughly investigate it. So merely having records from Ferris, for example, isn't enough just to say, well, because we had the records from Ferris, we can rule out EED, or because
they had... Well, based on the investigation that was made, could they have gone to trial with an EED defense?
No.
Okay. So
and the reason they couldn't...
And so it follows, does it not, that your EED arguments, numbers 1 and 4, rest on the foundation of or a claim that there was not a sufficient pretrial investigation made by initial defense counsel?
I think from the way the court's looking at it, the answer is yes. From the way I'm looking at it, it's a split answer.
Well, tell me what is wrong with the way the court is looking at it.
Well, I think the court's looking at it in a great way, so long as you buy into the concept that their investigation was rather poor, was not thorough, failed to uncover the appropriate information, and basically didn't meet the standards of Rompilla. Separately, Rompilla, Wiggins, German versus Horn, Alton versus Kearney, or Williams versus Taylor. And it seems to the appellant that if you miss five or six of the cases that this court used to remand in Norcross, you miss each of them independently, then collectively, it's virtually impossible to suggest the trial counsel, in fact, was competent in their investigation.
Let's assume that that's correct, that counsel should have done more and investigated. How do you satisfy the prejudice prong if the record is clear that your client wanted an all or nothing? He didn't want a lesser included offense conviction. Well, he wanted acquittal or conviction.
I think you have Mr. Taylor confused with my brilliant argument and Mr. Cook. Taylor did not want all or nothing, and in fact, there's a memo and this is at our opening appendix 955 from Mr. Connor, dated March 23rd, 2001. These dates are significant, and because, as you know, the murder occurred in 2000. Roughly the beginning of March, they brought in Kim Bryant as the big part of Team Taylor, even though she had never done a capital case. And now, on the eve of jury selection, when Judge Silverman announces that he's not suppressing the confession, Mr. Connor writes an internal memorandum in which he says, after lengthy discussions with Mr. Taylor, the defendant and counsel determined the pursuing A... extreme emotional distress case, and perhaps a murder second case was going to be in the defendant's best interest, given that the defendant could testify he did in fact cause the victim's death, but explain why in hopes that the jury would return a manslaughter or murder second conviction. Now, here's one of the key elements about where we are. I've been talking for the better part of 10 minutes and 16 seconds. We've already surpassed the mitigation that was presented to the jury. Okay? In page 8 of our brief was where we talked about the 7 pages of mitigation testimony that was presented on Mr. Taylor's behalf in a capital murder case in the 1990s in the state of in 2000 in the state of Delaware. I mean, that is just so remarkably deficient because he didn't fire counsel. He never said, with all due respect to the court, I want it all or nothing. In fact, Mr. Taylor was very cooperative. He was cooperative with Dr. Turner. He was cooperative with Dr. Tavani.
But haven't we just blurred two things? And it's one thing to say, I'm okay with lesser included offenses or some mental illness type defense in the trial phase. But when you're talking about mitigation, and wasn't his position with regard to mitigation at the penalty phase that he wanted no mitigation?
No, he wanted it. Well, it took, as it often does in these cases, Justice Holland, and you've heard this argument countless times, so I'm not going to beat on it too much. But he started out wanting no mitigation. Then he wanted some mitigation. The mitigation that developed, and this is what the court has to examine. What was the mitigation that was developed? It was dreadful. And then he decided that he didn't want the mitigation on the abuse. Now, you say, well, okay, doesn't he have, as a defendant, the ability to do that? And the answer to that is no, he doesn't. This is different than Cook. In Cook, the question was, what's the plea am I going to enter? Under 4209, the law says that all relevant mitigation evidence shall be presented. And what they did in this case, and I don't blame trial counsel for this, but you need to be a little smarter if you're going to do capital cases than to take this approach. Okay? They let the mother and the stepfather go back into the room with Mr. Taylor. That's kind of like going to PFA Friday with the protection from abuse cases and letting the boyfriend meet with the girlfriend with the two black eyes and say, honey, I love you, and if you don't go in and testify, we'll go out and have a nice dinner tonight. And that's what Dr. Dougherty testified. It's a reverse Miranda. Miranda wasn't designed to stop cops from beating people like Mr. Taylor's stepfather did to him. And by the way,
Mr. Gabe, you seem to be operating in a counterfactual universe here. The real evidence before the court was that there was, that the parents denied beating and abusing Mr. Taylor. There was no direct evidence of it, zero. And the only support for what you're arguing and what's being argued in the brief came from the second round of experts who in turn were relying upon the information they received from Mr. Taylor, who never testified.
Well, Justice Jacobs, I completely disagree with the court's interpretation that the parents denied it. It's true that they denied it to now Dr. Walsh, Mr. Walsh at the time. But when counsel met with the parents, and this is in page 9 of our brief, both the mother and the stepfather.
I'm sorry, is there a finding by the Superior Court based on evidence that the parents beat or abused Mr. Taylor? That's yes or no.
The Superior Court wrote that no one can have this type of life without having been taken advantage of, essentially, and intimates that clearly he had to suffer some type of abuse. The trial judge in the Superior Court just refused to recognize even though he agreed to brain damage, he refused to recognize that it was either from birth and or serial concussions, as Dr. Mack testified. I mean, the Superior Court wanted to have it both ways, which is why we're always here arguing to this court that in a capital case, counsel was not competent, because the Superior Court...
So the answer to my question is there's something that may be read between the lines in a finding of the Superior Court.
I don't think there's any question that the Superior Court believes...
Can I finish?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
There's nothing direct. That is, there is no direct evidence, and certainly no finding, no adjudication by anybody, that Mr. Taylor was the subject or object of physical beatings or abuse by his parents, which seems to be argued in the briefs as though it's an established fact.
Judge Silverman never directly made it a finding of fact. He indirectly, I would suggest, made it a finding of fact. Dr. Turner, in his initial interview, talked about a very abusive childhood and never at any point went back on that finding. Dr. Dougherty found that there was an abusive childhood. Ferris found that there was an abusive childhood.
Based on information from whom?
From Mr. Taylor. And at some point you said...
Doesn't your argument presuppose that we have to accept that as a factual premise in order for that argument to go anywhere?
No, I think what you have to do is say that in this case, counsel had a duty to turn this stuff over to Turner, to Vonnie, Walsh, or even people that were competent to do this type of work, like Mack and Dougherty, and let them look at it and do their part. They got some of these records. They got the Department of Correction records the first night of jury selection. They on the first day of trial, they got the juvenile records. You can't try a case like that, Justice Jacobs. It's just completely...
That may be, but
what I'm trying to find out is
what is the evidentiary foundation for all of the arguments that start from the premise that there was parental physical abuse?
Because, I don't think they all start with that.
No, I said of those which do.
I think if you look at what Mr. Connor wrote in his memo, Mother said that Mr. Taylor needed to be disciplined. He who spares the rod, not spoils the child. These are his words. That Mom said, he who spares the rod hates his son.
Who
loves him takes care to chastise him.
That could be equally consistent with the spanking or downright physical abuse.
Well, and this court has passed time and time again on what constitutes physical abuse in DFS cases, and I suggest on more than one occasion you all have found that spanking that goes beyond the lines is without a doubt. Now, here's where the physical abuse ties in.
Before you go to that, uncharacteristically, this may sound meddlesome, but you said at the beginning of this stage of the argument, quoting from the statute, about inference that there's an obligation to supply all mitigating evidence.
Relevant.
Is there a comment before that in the statute that doesn't mandate that aggravating, non-statutory aggravating factors or mitigating evidence be introduced at all? And the reason I ask that question is, you seem to infer that if you present any form of mitigation, you must present all mitigation. And the client can't say, I'm okay with this mitigating evidence, but I don't want men and women on a jury to perceive that I'm less of a man I am in my own mind by suggesting to them that my parents physically abused me when I was growing up. So I don't want any of that in.
Well,
let's assume that the record would support that. I want to get a better understanding of this concept that all mitigating evidence must be discovered no matter what it is, and it all must be presented. Otherwise, somebody's fallen short of the standard of the reasonably competent attorney.
I don't think it's reasonable to say that all has to be discovered, because I think that we're setting a bar then so enormously high, we might as well just abolish the death penalty. All reasonably available mitigation evidence has to be available, and it's not supposed to be gotten on the day, the week before trial, or the month before trial, or the night before trial.
Well, to what extent does the defendant control what is to be presented and what is not? Because the way you phrased it, it sounds like it's a mandate that overrides the defendant's choice of what evidence would be introduced at the penalty phase. And is that a correct statement of the law?
Well, no. The first mandate is they have to get the evidence. And in this case, they didn't have all the evidence. So to say to Mr. Taylor, Mom is saying, Milton, we want you not to put this out because it will embarrass the family. Right? How is that just presupposes that Mr. Taylor is aware of everything that's out there. But if you go back...
Is your argument then that had counsel made available to Mr. Taylor all of the mitigation evidence that was reasonably available, but failed to do so because they didn't adequately investigate, that would have changed Taylor's mind about presenting evidence of abuse by his parents or his mother and his stepfather during the penalty phase?
Well, based upon our position, Mr. Chief Justice, it could have been that there was never a penalty phase because they could have developed either an EED, they could have developed an EED without the abuse evidence. And if they do that, then you don't even have a penalty phase. Now, getting back more specifically to this, and I know I'm eating into my time here, but getting back more specifically to the other part, you have to get everything together, you have to share it with the defendant, and they have to be able to make an informed decision. And you don't make an informed decision by letting the pedophile tell the kid, I'm not going to have sex with you anymore, but I'll take you to Disney World if this case goes away. That's what happened here. They let the parents into this room to talk to the guy about not presenting what is some of the most powerful evidence, which if they had mental health professionals, which they didn't, if they had the mental health professionals, would have tied it all together.
Now, I understand that argument.
Well, that's the prejudice.
What I'm trying to get straight in my own mind, and I'm simply asking for your help here, let's assume that they did do a thorough investigation, present to Mr. Taylor all of the information that was reasonably available about abuse when he was a child by his mother and father figure. What in the record suggests that Mr. Taylor's mind would be changed when he said, I don't want that evidence such as you have given me presented? What would have tipped the scales?
Well, I don't think you can do that. I think it goes back to the same thing as to what constitutes prejudice and the fact that ultimately you have to speculate because you can't point to the abstract. And with someone with Milton Taylor's difference, including Susan Perot's showing the difference in his performance versus his functioning IQ and the fact that that deals with impulsivity, et cetera, and the effects that that would have on a person like Milton Taylor making a decision under pressure, I don't think the court can pinpoint or force Mr. Taylor to be pinpointed into saying that this would be the change because it's impossible. And that's why you have mental health experts. That's why we had mental health experts. I don't know why they didn't have mental health experts.
I'm sorry, is the answer to the Chief Justice's question that you presume that there would be a different outcome? You say you can't speculate, which means that there's no solid evidence that there would have been a different outcome. That is, that Mr. Taylor would have, you know, presented with more information, would have decided or instructed his lawyers differently. So is your argument that therefore we'll have to presume that he would have made a more enlightened decision once he had more information?
No, the argument on that point, Justice Jacobs, would be that despite the trial court's opinion, Dr. Dougherty is the only mental health expert to address the question because Dr. Devani didn't. Dr. Devani said he could make a way.
My question is yes or no. Is your argument that you presume a different outcome, or is it is there, or do you not? And if you
well, the
do
evidence
not,
is yes, there would be a different outcome because Dr. Dougherty found he's incapable of making a valid constitutional waiver. So there would be a different outcome, and it would fall upon counsel to make the judgment and strategic decision as to what's the appropriate trial strategy. And that's really what it comes down to. You can't make appropriate trial strategy decisions that when you don't have the information to properly advance them. I'm down to 20-some seconds if I...
No, actually, it's the red light. You're 30 seconds over.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And you've used your rebuttal if you saved any. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Elizabeth McFarlane on behalf of the State. Milton Taylor made it very clear to his attorneys that it was an all or nothing. He did not want to spend the rest of his life in prison. Both of his attorneys believed that from the beginning, and that was their understanding after all their meetings.
Are you applying this to both the trial and the penalty phase?
He changed his mind in the penalty phase, only to the extent of letting in a certain amount. But yes, he still wanted the death penalty, but the reason he wanted, he sort of acquiesced to the parental pressure to put in some mitigation in terms of remorse, and felt that that would make the family happy to do that.
What about the memo that Mr. Gabay was reading to us saying that we're confusing, or I'm confusing this with the Cook case? The EED memo that said it was beneficial, and it was to show it wasn't all or nothing.
Well, both attorneys testified that they believed it was all or nothing. Whether they were trying to develop early on other options for trial in case they could convince him, and particularly one of the attorneys was trying to convince the defendant to give her enough to try an EED defense, but he would not, in fact. She testified that by his own statements, he made it clear ethically they couldn't present an EED defense. So,
well, Mr. Gabay didn't read that memo incorrectly, did he?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, that's not consistent with an attorney's view that he hadn't acquiesced in at least exploring the EED defense.
He had, after the suppression, he wanted pursue an accident defense. He was still trying to pursue a defense at trial. But he made it clear that unless he could get out at some point to see his children, which potentially, like, he could spend 10 years in jail, but he didn't want to spend the rest of his life there. And unfortunately for him, he was a habitual offender, so if they had done an EED, even if they had a factual basis to do it, that would have ended up as a life sentence if it was reduced to manslaughter for him. So ultimately, that wasn't his goal either. Things are fluid when they're working on a defense, and they have to look at other options and present them to him. But that doesn't mean that he didn't, that he changed his mind about not wanting to spend his life in prison. He certainly wanted to have access to his children, to get out, to do something. And if he couldn't have that, he would rather die. That was the position that his attorneys understood. And
well, the question, at least as I understand the way it's presented to us, is the memo stands for the proposition that counsel at least address the viability of an EED defense with him. He agreed that to go forward with that, but they failed to investigate sufficiently to develop sufficient evidence to move forward with that defense at the trial stage. Is that an incorrect way of reading it?
Well, it's incorrect in that there was no factual basis for an EED defense, and they investigated sufficiently to discover that. That was not a viable defense for him. He knew.
Okay, so I'm at least correct that the other side says it would have been had their investigation been adequate. That's their position as I understand it. At least it could have been presented, maybe not as a ultimately successful defense, but it was an option. and a jury would have heard about that during the trial phase and probably remembered substantial portions of it during any penalty phase.
Well, there, I'm not sure how they could have presented it at trial without a base, a factual basis to present it. There was no...
You mean apart from any investigation, your position is even if they'd gone out and found all the information that's been suggested to us was readily available out there, but counsel simply didn't explore it, there still would have been no factual basis for it.
That's correct.
Okay.
Because an EED is very dependent on the defendant and his reaction to an event. And he had already told them that he knew the victim was pregnant, he knew it was by another man, he knew that she was sleeping with other men. That didn't bother him. And his explanation of what had happened precluded them from moving forward on the EED defense. And with no basis, they really couldn't go that route. So that really was not. Then, so when they got to the, he, because he was consistent in his view that he did not want, if it got to a penalty phase, he did not want life, he would prefer death. The attorneys, although they didn't have to, did anyway produce a mitigation case in case he did change his mind. That is a good practice, and since sometimes people do, and they presented it, and they went through a waiver with him, with the court, and the court found that he was competent to waive, and he did. And that was his decision. To say then that allowing the parents
now,
access...
Well, help me understand at least. Why is that his decision? Why isn't that a tactic for counsel to decide about?
Because it's an outcome. The client is able to decide the outcome he is seeking in the litigation, and his outcome at that point was death. That's a client, that's a defendant decision. Just as whether to plead guilty or not guilty, this is the same. He made a decision, this is what where he wanted the litigation to go, and then it was up to counsel after that, but that is his decision.
It's suggested that the statute mandates that all mitigating evidence that's reasonably available be presented. If this defendant's preferred outcome was the death penalty, why did he allow any evidence to be presented at all, at the, of any kind, at the penalty hearing?
Because it was to make his family feel better. That was his rationale.
How do we know that?
That was in the record. I can't, I'm sorry, right now point to it, but that he, and that was what counsel understood, was that after meeting with the family, that wasn't the family that decided that he shouldn't present any of the abuse. In fact, he wasn't going to have any of the mitigation presented until after he talked to the family, and then he stayed with his decision not to present any of the abuse, but agreed that remorse could come in and that the fact that his family would miss him, which would allow his mother and his aunt to testify.
Ms. McFarland, is it your position that the counsel were obligated under the Cook decision to observe Mr. Taylor's injunction or direction that he wanted all or nothing?
Yes.
They weren't free to override that?
No. That was his decision, and that was a rational decision, and he made it clear to them that that was what he was seeking.
If Cook did not create that obligation, that is, if it didn't apply, then counsel would be free to present whatever mitigation evidence they wanted. That is, they thought would be valid from based on their own judgment. Is that correct?
The state would disagree. It was always the defendant's right to waive presentation of mitigation. And that is his choice.
Well, it appears, at least from the briefs and from what I understood from Mr. Gabe, that counsel was not bound by the ruling in Cook, even though that ruling took place later, that they could have, if not outright flouted it, and gone in their own direction, they could have at least adhered to the letter of it, if not the spirit, by putting in additional kinds of mitigation evidence, had they done a proper job in investigating the facts.
Well, the state does not agree. If you go back to Red Dog, he was permitted to waive, and that was earlier. And the court has found that the client's goal in litigation is what drives the litigation. And in this case, at the penalty phase, the goal of the defendant was a death sentence. And it would have been counter to that if they had gone ahead against his wishes and put in whatever mitigation they had discovered.
So help me with this. Of all of the mitigating factors that have been identified by Mr. Taylor, is it the state's view that remorse and the fact his family would miss him, that was it? That was the only mitigation evidence that the defense counsel were allowed to submit on his behalf? In other words, I'm struggling to figure out what mitigation did Mr. Taylor ask not to be presented versus what else was out there that could have been presented, and is there something that could have been presented that wasn't presented?
He did not want the abuse, physical or mental abuse. He did not want the family estrangement and the or his mental health put out there. He agreed ultimately, he modified that and agreed that the allowing a life sentence would what would be the difference between what he could do with a life sentence in prison, that he could function in a prison, the remorse and the significant loss of loved ones, and his history, the history of drug abuse or addiction.
Now,
that was limited.
Having said all that, and the record reflects, and the Superior Court addresses the fact that the defense did prepare a notebook anyway,
yeah,
with the mitigation that included evidence that he didn't want, and they said to the trial judge, we didn't present this evidence because our client said not to present it, but here's a notebook with what we have assembled and what we might have presented if we would have had the client's permission.
That's correct.
And then, in fact, that's referred to in the Superior Court opinion.
Yes.
And that's why the Superior Court said it wasn't really a Gardner issue, because in Gardner, the sentencing information that was considered and relied upon was never made known to the defendant. But in this case, what the judge relied on was supplied by the defendant.
That's correct.
So to a certain extent, and there was mitigation beyond what was testified to at the hearing because it was in this notebook.
That's correct.
But it wasn't presented to a jury, correct?
That's correct.
And didn't the judge say he wasn't going to consider it?
He did.
But he still considered it and drew from the mitigation notebook information that was used to support the imposition of the death penalty. And because he cited it as a factor, don't we have to presume that it was a material factor in his decision?
He, in fact, reviewed it in post-conviction without that information and said that it was not a deciding factor. He, in fact, said that he went to that notebook because of the 10-2 vote, and he was concerned that, in general fairness, that he should consider any mitigation that was available to him in light of the 10-2 vote.
But as a practical matter, he didn't draw from it mitigating information. He drew from it information that supported the harshest sentence possible,
which he basically had already come to the conclusion that he was going to give a death sentence, and he said specifically that he was in there looking for something to ameliorate that vote. So in that situation, it's clear that he was already headed toward a death.
As I understand the Vice Chancellor's question, it is, did he make a finding in regard to any aggravating material in that binder or that folder? And if he did make a finding, doesn't that stand for the proposition that he believed it was material, no matter what he may have said at a post-conviction hearing?
Well, the only reference he made was to the lack of motivation that Mr. Taylor had, and that was clear from all sorts of sources that there was a lack of motivation given his history and his inability to stay in school and his criminal history and everything else. So it's not as if it were a dramatically different finding of fact that wasn't out there.
Ms. McFarland, turning to a different question momentarily, can you tell us why the state felt it necessary to put before the jury the testimony of a deputy attorney general to the effect that Mr. Taylor was already or would be a habitual criminal?
That was to show that...
Well, it's distinguished from just attempting to get a stipulation of that fact.
I do not know from the record whether there was any attempt to get that stipulation or not. So that's not part of the record, and I'm unaware. However, any of the propensities or anything related to criminal conduct or such on the defendant is admissible as aggravating circumstances in a penalty phase.
I think the question is more directed to, isn't it unusual to have counsel who represents a party testify as a witness in a form that would suggest they're opining on the law to the lawgiver, who is the judge in the case? Isn't that somewhat anomalous?
I don't think that he was put on to opine about the law other than to show that he was eligible for something under the law. It wasn't an interpretation.
Is that not a legal question? Eligibility under the law for something, as you put it? What else could it be? I mean, this isn't a law professor drawn from the academy to come in and testify generically about habitual offender status. This is someone who serves as counsel to a party in a case testifying about the law to a jury and a judge. Isn't that bizarre?
Well, this was not the only case that has occurred in.
Does that make it less bizarre?
No, it makes it less unique. However, I think that the object here was to show that...
I know what the object was. The question is that appropriate? Is that prejudicial? Should it have ever happened?
The state does not see that it was overly prejudicial.
Well, if the purpose was to influence the jury as opposed to the judge, don't you think it would be unduly influential to have a deputy attorney general telling the jury that this defendant was a habitual criminal when the jury is being asked to decide whether to recommend death or life?
Well, in fact, the defense counsel argued that the state, by not having filed a petition for a habitual offender when he was eligible, must have found mitigating circumstances regarding Mr. Taylor, and in fact implied that there clearly, if he was such a bad guy, the state would have filed the habitual offender petition when he first became eligible, but the state, in their discretion, felt he wasn't deserving of it. That was an argument made in closing.
Well, I mean, the options are to stipulate that based on the convictions that had actually been entered against Mr. Taylor, that under the law he was a habitual criminal, or to brief it and have the judge make that determination as a matter of law. And then the third would be what actually happened here, to go before the jury with a witness who has all the majesty of the Attorney General of Delaware's office to testify to that effect. What is, how can that be anything other than unduly prejudicial?
In light of this case and the evidence against Mr. Taylor, I don't think that changed the balance. And it was certainly used by the defense in closing as a fairly strong argument. counter to the state's position.
Help me understand. You say this isn't unique. At habitual offender hearings, are deputy attorneys general testifying, or are you?
No, I believe there was one other case in it. I do not recall which case it was where a deputy attorney testified as to habitual offender.
A capital case?
I believe so.
You would then pigeonhole it into this arena. You wouldn't have deputy attorney generals simply generally testifying before fact finders about how the facts in this particular case fit an individual statute, and therefore the jury should reach the conclusion that the statutory requirements had been met?
Certainly not in any guilt phase, no. No.
Why is there a difference between a guilt phase and a penalty phase?
Well, this is to show the fact finders the propensities of the and history, criminal history.
I know the purpose for which it's offered, and the alternative I suggested earlier that would be at least arguably neutral and non-prejudicial would be to take someone from the academy who is an expert in criminal law who might be able to testify about habitual offender status generally. But to say before a fact finder in any criminal case through the mouth of a deputy attorney general who is from the same office as the prosecutor in that case, ladies and gentlemen fact finders, lady or gentleman judge fact finder, here are the facts, here's how they are applied to the law, here is the conclusion that should be reached. That's not what the Code of Professional Responsibility says is supposed to happen, and it's not generally the practice at this state for that to happen. Why did it happen here? Other than the fact it was useful.
It is not part of the record as to whether there was any discussion about a stipulation. They were certainly aware that Mr. Wallace was going to testify, and there was no objection to it. That's clear in the record. But there is no record about discussions regarding stipulation or not.
I'm not thinking in terms of stipulation. I understand your point about there's no objection, and that's fascinating.
And it was not raised as an issue on appeal.
I understand it wasn't, but it's of concern to some of us.
Understood, Your Honor. In any case, ultimately, I'll wrap up here. This case hinges on the fact that Milton Taylor wanted all or nothing and then changed his mind later and now wants to go back and judge what his counsel did when they were acting based on what they understood him to be saying, the information that was available at the time, and he should not be judged, that counsel should not now be judged on what could have been when he told them not to look for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.